Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to convene the March 7th, 2017 meeting of the Subcommittee on Natural Resources for Ways and Means. And I'm going to open a work session for DLCD. And with that, I'd like to ask staff, please, to introduce the item.
Thank you, Co-Chair Witt, members of the subcommittee. Coming for you today is the Department of Land Conservation and Development with a request that you allow them to apply for a federal grant from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in the amount of $300,000. And today to present the request is the Director Jim Rue and Matt Spangler, who is their Senior Coastal Policy Analyst.
Welcome back.
Good to be here.
Good to see that you're bringing money to our state. We'll take it wherever we can get it. please proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, members, again, for the record, Jim Rue, Director, DLCD. Last week, we spent a fair bit of time talking about general fund grants and the fact that those grants were being redirected in the governor's recommended budget towards coastal seismic resilience. And at the time, we said that while $1.5 million wasn't a lot of money, it would get us started. And I think we mentioned in response perhaps to a question from you, Senator Taylor, about how many of the communities we thought we could get done. And we said probably five, and that we had roughly a five-year agenda to address resilience in communities up and down the coast. This request that we have to you today to apply for this grant in no way displaces any of that general fund money. In fact, it is part of what we said last week, that we're looking to use the general fund money as leverage to attract other money to do the job more quickly and more completely. So that's why we're here. This is an example of just that kind of supplemental federal money that will help move the agenda forward. So with that, Matt Spangler will go through a little bit of detail of how we propose to spend the money if we get it, and then we'll leave it to you for your deliberations. So thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Witt and Frederick, and members of the subcommittee. I'm Matt Spangler. I'm a coastal policy analyst with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. As you heard from your staff and from Director Rue, we're here this afternoon to request authorization to apply for a federal grant from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Thanks, Jim.
Didn't help.
I seem to be feeding back here.
We may have the two mics. There we go. Thank you.
All right. So this is a grant through NOAA's Coastal Resilience Grant Program, and that's a nationwide program that provides funding to coastal and Great Lake states and also the territories for coastal resilience activities. And it provides funding in really two kind of broad categories of funding. One is ecosystem resilience, which is focused mostly on coastal habitat restoration. And I think, in fact, you're going to hear from our friends from OWEB in a minute about that part of the program. The other piece of the program is aimed at building resilience in coastal communities, and it's that latter aspect of the program under which we would pursue this application, specifically targeting tsunami resilience in our Oregon coastal communities. So the basics of the grant are really as follows. Our proposed application to NOAA is $300,000. That would, if funded, fund work over an 18-month period that would commence in October and extend through April of 2019. The work would be accomplished through a partnership with Dalgami, the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and five of our coastal cities that are at risk from tsunami, and those cities are Gearhart, Rockaway Beach, Lincoln City, Newport, and Port Orford. The work itself would really consist of two major components, the first being funding to Dalgami to produce what they've branded as their Beat the Wave modeling product. And what that is a detailed time and distance modeling for tsunami evacuation. And it's detailed really down to the individual point in a community. So at any specific point in the community using this modeling, the community can assess how long it takes people to evacuate at different paces and different speeds, and couple that with the projected arrival time of the tsunami. So it paints a very vivid picture of what the tsunami evacuation needs are within the particular community. In the few communities where we have this product already, for the work that we do focused on community development planning and decisions, we found it to be a foundational tool for planning decisions for communities and assessing and prioritizing needs for evacuation infrastructure. So then that leads directly to the second piece of the project, and that would be to take that map product along with the published guidance that we have produced on tsunami resilience and assist, provide direct technical assistance, and also provide direct funding assistance to the five project communities to develop land use strategies and planning applications using that tsunami evacuation modeling product. Currently, under a separate grant with the Office for Coastal Management, we have similar work underway with several other coastal communities. And we found in soliciting interest for that project, we had more interest than we had resources to support. So this grant would allow us to extend that work and continue that momentum with communities that are interested in doing that work. So briefly, in terms of the budget nuts and bolts, in round numbers, there would be $137,000 directed to Dalgami to produce the modeling product, $88,000 to DLCD for staff time, travel, geographic information system mapping work, other direct support to the communities that will be doing the planning work, and then $15,000 to each of the five communities for a total of $75,000 passed through to the local governments. There is a 50% match required for the grant, and we're proposing to provide that grant through our indirect costs that would otherwise be billable to the grant, but we're going to contribute those as match in this case. And then we'd also be looking to the local communities to provide in-kind match, so some of their staff time, probably time for appointed elected officials, other folks that would be involved in decision-making processes related to the project. So I think that provides really my summary of the project and the work that we propose to do. So on behalf of the department, I'd like to thank the committee for considering our request today, and be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much, Representative Esquivel. Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chair. When we say planning, I believe that we're speaking of holding areas above the waterline of the tsunami. And the reason I say this is because your infrastructure may be all gone in the first place. You couldn't drive a car 10 feet. I've looked at pictures of Alaska in 1964 when half the street was 30 feet higher than the other half the street. So I assume that that's what we're talking about, staging areas and places for people to go, because they may have to do it on foot.
Quite likely.
Yes. Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel. Yes. Typically, the tsunami evacuation is going to be a pedestrian evacuation proposition. You're not going to be able to get in your car and drive anywhere, and we're talking about an arrival time of something like 15 to 20 minutes. So you can imagine by the time people sort of get their wits about them after this tremendous ground-shaking event of the earthquake and then mobilize to head for high ground, they're going to be doing that on foot. And that's really, you're right, the modeling product identifies how long it's going to take folks to get from point A to point B in that kind of a scenario. And then it also identifies areas where people would be assembling and so forth post-event.
Yes. Also, are we now in the future in the coastal communities doing our planning 200 feet or higher above the waterline? Because I would assume that we wouldn't want people to be down by the ocean anymore, because this isn't a matter of if it's going to happen, it's a matter of when it will happen.
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, you know, it's a really good point. It's a here's the conundrum that our communities are faced with. Many of our coastal communities have 100 plus years of development that has taken place without knowledge or regard for this particular hazard. So there's a lot of investment that has gone on in those communities. So part of this exercise is to be able to scientifically assess which of these areas in the community are at the greatest risk, and at this point we're really talking life safety risk, and then have communities make planning decisions for the long term about how they want to address that as their community continues to develop. So in the case, for example, of certain kinds of essential facilities like police and fire stations, schools, that kind of stuff, we know that that can't go down there, and in fact communities are working actively on initiatives to relocate some of those facilities that are down there now and we know are in harm's way. So that's kind of the exercise that, and you know, and that's going to be different for every community. We want them to have that discussion, think about those risks, and then make some decisions about how they want to proceed going forward.
Co-Chair Frederick.
Thank you. Are we being too optimistic on the 15 to 20 minutes?
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt. So for the arrival time of the tsunami?
Yes.
You know, it varies depending on your location on the coast, but that is actually part of the modeling product that Dalgami has produced, and they can produce what we think are really, based on the state of the science, some pretty accurate arrival times for those tsunamis. And it does vary. Some places it may be as little as 10 to 12 minutes. Other places it might be, you know, you start getting up the Columbia River, for example, in Astoria, you know, you might have more like 25, 30 minutes.
This is an unabashed promotion, so I'm warning you right now.
Thanks for the warning.
Yeah, you may need it. Lincoln City and Newport have managed, Lincoln County have managed to put together some pretty good caches using shipping containers, something that I have a bill doing suggesting just that we start setting up shipping containers around the state to be able to handle this kind of thing. They're doing it. Are there other places that are setting up caches for emergency supplies?
Co-Chair Frederick, yes. There are other communities on the coast that are doing that same kind of work. Cannon Beach, for example, is actively involved in a project on some city-owned property that's east of Main 101 and up on high ground with emergency caches, yes.
Right, thank you.
Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. We had a presentation in emergency services, and the farther south you go, the more of a chance you're going to have. I think we're at a 43% chance off the coast of Brookings. And the farther north you go, the less it is. And I think in that area you're talking about, it's about 12%, 14%, something like that. But this is based on historical data, because they drill down. They can figure out with the sediment, the way it's settled, how often these things are. And they went back, I think, 5,000 years on it. But looks like if it does happen, or when it happens, we're going to catch it in the south more than they will in the north.
We get to buy cheaper running shoes in our...
Right. We have to buy Nikes.
Additional questions or comments, anyone? When you were before us previously, you talked about some reductions, grant reductions from NOAA. So this would be an increase in another area.
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, yes. So what we talked about was a 30% reduction to our basic coastal planning grant. Mm-hmm. That remains in effect for the foreseeable future. But this is from a separate funding source to address these particular kinds of coastal hazards. So yes, they are separate.
All right. Thank you. I would ask if the analyst has a recommendation at this point.
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, Kathy Conley with Chief Financial Office, and we recommend that you approve the request.
Thank you very much. And Matt, recommendation from LFO?
The Legislative Fiscal Office approves recommends approval of the request also.
Wonderful. We're in sync here. This is good news. And would you tell us what we may be voting on?
Your Co-Chair Wade, what you're voting on right now is whether or not you'll be asking for a motion from one of the committee members.
And, yes.
And typically the motion is to move the LFO recommendation, which is the approval of the request, and then the request will be moved to the full committee with the subcommittee's recommendation of approval.
All right. Very good. We teed that up for you,
yes,
Co-Chair
Ferger. Thank you very much. So I move the approval of the LFO request, and I have a feeling that because Senator Girard is not here, we can either tell him he's going to do it or I will take it.
All right. Very good. So the motion before you is to move the LFO recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, hearing none, is there any objection to that motion? Seeing none, hearing none, motion passes. And Co-Chair Frederick, you volunteered to carry that.
It's one of the two, either the two of us, since Senator Girard's not here, that would be me.
All right, very good. Thank you very much. And I'm going to close the work session on LCDC's federal grant application and open a work session on OWEB, or Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board's federal grant application. And we'll wait here for folks to shift chairs. All right, and if we could have staff please tell us what's before us.
Yes, Co-Chair Witt, the board is here today seeking approval to submit a grant application to NOAA in the amount of $600,000. The grant application is due March 15, 2017, and the funds will be used to support the Oregon Tide Gate infrastructure discussion project.
Well, thank you very much. This is better than Christmas here today. So everybody's bringing money before us. Director Lofsgarden.
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, members of the committee, for the record, Maida Lofsgarden, Executive Director with the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. I have here with me today Jillian McCarthy, who is our partnerships coordinator and is the lead on this project. I'm going to provide a brief summary. I appreciate Mr. Spangler's testimony before, because he described the grant program to you, and we are applying to the same program. So I'm going to focus my time just talking to you about the specific requests that we have before you today. So just by way of background, as most of you know, tide gates are commonly used to control water in tidally influenced areas, all the way along the coast and up the Columbia as well. There's a growing challenge in the state of aging tide gates and associated infrastructure. Back in 2001, the state passed a set of fish passage requirements that included fish passage around tide gate infrastructure. Tide gates typically last 15 to 20 years, and it's been about that length of time since the fish passage rules were passed. And what we're seeing in this state is a definite increase in the number of tide gates that need repair or replacement. The challenge that we have, and our agency is one of the agencies that funds that replacement to achieve benefits around fish passage. The challenge that we have is we don't really have a good handle on how many of those exist in the state and in what condition those are. We were approached back in August of last year, both us and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, by the Cattlemen's Association and the Farm Bureau, who were raising some pretty serious concerns about the aging infrastructure and the cost that it would be for landowners to replace those tide gates meeting the new fish passage requirements. Sometimes that is as much as a tenfold increase in the cost of tide gate replacement. Since that point in time, the four organizations, OEB, ODFW, the Cattlemen, and the Farm Bureau, convened a large group of stakeholders, including other agriculture organizations, conservation organizations, watershed councils, conservation districts, state and federal agencies to start digging into this challenge. As a result of that, we have identified a need to really focus on five key elements so that we can get a handle on the size and scale of this issue. First is to do some extensive local outreach in communities. Anytime that state agencies go into communities and say we're here to help, that's not necessarily the best and first conversation. And so we want to work closely with counties, with the Coastal Caucus, if possible, as well as with the organizations I mentioned before, to reach out to local communities so that we can really get a handle on what the issue is in those communities. After that, we will work with those communities to compile a Coast and Columbia-wide baseline tide gate inventory. Will be a voluntary inventory using publicly available data like data from Google Earth. And then we will go out to landowners and ask for their voluntary participation so we can get an idea of the condition and the replacement costs for those tide gates. All participation will be voluntary on the part of landowners. We will also be developing what we are calling a decision support tool, which will help funders and local communities to prioritize investments. So as an example, OEB invests in native fish and wildlife habitat. That means there's a fairly limited suite of these tide gates that fit our granting program, a lot smaller than what the need actually is. But if there's a federal infrastructure program or agencies like U.S. Department of Agriculture who have other priorities, we want to be able to find those projects that match the funding sources and really be able to highlight those and help local communities plan for the most critical projects. The last two pieces that we'll be focusing on are what we're calling an engineering toolbox. At this point in time, there is one replacement alternative for tide gates. It is an outstanding alternative, but there is only one, and it is very expensive. We feel that working with local communities, contractors, engineers, university system, and others, we can find other alternatives that might be more conducive for landowners at a reduced cost, and also partner with folks like Department of Fish and Wildlife in reducing costs for replacement. Finally, we'll be working with federal agencies to explore opportunities for streamlining permitting and also landowner regulatory assurances. So if you're going to replace a tide gate and you're going to provide some habitat as a result, is there a way that we can provide some regulatory certainty for those landowners? So that is the summary of the project. The request that we have is $600,000 of federal funds to be matched with $300,000 that would be a request to our Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board as a cash match. There would be additional in-kind match from our other partners, but as was mentioned by Mr. Spangler, it's a 50% match requirement. So we are including the OEB grant as a cash match. Jillian or I would be more than happy to answer any questions. We appreciate your consideration of this request.
Thank you very much. Subcommittee members, anything for our panel members? Just want to thank you all very, very much for appearing today, but also for the tremendous work that you do in a number of our communities. And this could hold potential to have some economic development for some local communities. Are there any projections? Is there an average cost or a price tag on a tide gate?
Co-chairs Witten and Frederick, thank you for the question. There are a range. What we hear for some of the individual tide gates that are just for single landowner, the cost has gone from $3,000 to $5,000 per tide gate to $30,000 to $50,000 per tide gate for replacement. With the alternative that's available, we're working on one project right now that's a $10 million project and will involve two local contractors working most of the summer to put it together. So I do think there are some great opportunities for local economic development. What we find in these projects is that they are generally using local contractors. It's much different than a highway interchange project where you're bringing probably somebody from out of state. These projects are local with local contractors. They stay in local communities. We have a study that says that for the projects that we invest in, for every $1 million invested, there's an average of 15 to 24 local jobs created out of those projects, and this would fit well within that requirement, being the type of infrastructure project it is.
Did you say 15 to 24 per?
Per million.
Per million.
Yes.
Well, there'll probably be some very happy local contractors who've got an idle excavator and a dump truck or two and somebody who wants to sell some gravel. So not only protecting our dikes in our communities, but also providing some employment in the local communities. It has every appearance that it would be a win-win-win all the way around.
Thank you, Coach Irwin.
Thank you very much. Anything further, subcommittee members? Not seeing anything. Is there a recommendation?
There's a recommendation, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I recommend that we accept the ALIFO recommendation for this particular grant.
All right. ALIFO?
CFO recommends you approve the request.
I'm a CFO. Excuse me. I'm sorry. And ALIFO?
Yes, we also recommend approval of the request.
We're all tracking. We have a motion before us, and the motion is to move the LFO recommendation. Subcommittee members, is there discussion on that? Not seeing any, not hearing any. Are there any objections to the motion? Last chance. Motion's adopted. Co-Chair Frederick, aside from yourself, would that's you it. Like to call carry this?
I think that's what I'm going to end up
doing. I think you're going to have to. So right. Thank you for volunteering.
Oh, yes, sure.
All right. And with that, again, thank you very, very much for everything that you're doing. And I am going to close the work session on OWEB's federal grant application, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5508, the Department of Environmental Quality. And Mr. Siebert, do you have some preliminary information for us? Correction. It appears that we have a typo here.
Yeah.
And I am going to correct the record and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5518. That would be 5518. Mr. Siebert?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and I'll take full blame for that. Senate Bill 5508 is the 1517 rebalance bill. It was just passed out of full committee, and I think I have that bill on my mind. So Senate Bill 5518 is the budget bill for the Department of Environmental Quality. They're here for the beginning of 4 days. You'll hear from them for the next 3 days, and then we're hoping to keep the fourth day open for public testimony. And in the interest of time, I think I'll just turn it over to the department.
Very good. Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, members. For the record, I'm Richard Whitman, the director of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. I want to do a few introductions before we get into the presentation. I have to my right Ed Armstrong, who is the chair of the Environmental Quality Commission. The Environmental Quality Commission is the policy board that oversees the department. It sets rules. It also hires and fires the director. And it also approves the agency's request budget, so it's an important commission. And then to my left, I have the newest commissioner on the commission, Sam Barrasso. And with your indulgence, what I'm going to do, co-chairs, is just give a few introductory remarks myself and then ask Mr. Armstrong and Mr. Barrasso to give a few remarks as well.
Very good.
So I want to note the fact that I'm a new director and that the Department of Environmental Quality has been through a certain amount of turmoil over the past year. We've been through, I think it's four directors in the past year. There's been concern over air toxics. We've also had some internal angst in the agency as we've moved our two largest offices across the river in Portland to a consolidated location. And you also get the sense there's some confusion, frankly, about responsibilities and accountability and leadership in the agency. And I want to speak to that for a moment. I'm here today as the director of this department because I think there's an enormous opportunity to turn this agency around and to regain the trust of the people of Oregon. I think that trust was damaged over the past year. I think there is a very strong commission behind me. There is also a strong team of senior managers in the agency as well. And the staff at DEQ aren't there, you know, just for a paycheck. They're there almost without exception because they believe in the mission of the agency. We're also entering, really, I think, a new era, in part because of our improvements in communication, of public expectations about information about our environment. And I think increasingly there's an expectation that this department put out information for the public so they can be involved and engaged in decisions about the environment. So I want to let you know a few things that I'm in the middle of doing and will be doing over the course of the next year. First of all, the agency underwent a reorganization a couple of years ago and moved away from, at least in headquarters, from an organization around air, land, and water. That reorganization effort, I believe, was well-intentioned to try to break down some silos, but it's had the effect of confusing people about who's in charge, who's accountable, who is responsible for delivering results in particular areas. So we are going to be moving back to the more traditional structure around air, land, and water over the course of the next year. I'm also working with the senior managers in the agency to reinvigorate our leadership team. I'll talk about that a little bit more today in terms of who's on that. Again, making clear what the expectations are for myself and for managers in the agency. And then finally, on the communications front, we are also taking some steps to improve our capacity there and to at least start to meet those public expectations about putting information out to the public, not expecting the public to come to the agency with public records requests, another subject I'll talk about a little bit later. So with that very brief introduction, I'd like to turn it over to Chair Armstrong for a few remarks.
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, members of the Natural Resource Ways and Means Committee. My name is Ed Armstrong, and I live in Hebo, Oregon, which is in Tillamook County, if you're not familiar with Hebo. I currently serve as chair of the Environmental Quality Commission, and I first want to thank you on behalf of all Oregonians for your service, particularly in these challenging times. As all of us who have dedicated time and energy to our communities, we recognize how both our actions and our policies shape the future of Oregon. I have lived all my 65 years in this state, and it has been my great privilege to have known and worked with many great Oregonians, including Governor Tom McCall, during my senior year at Forest Grove High School, where we as students hosted him as a keynote speaker for the first Earth Day. Living in this amazing state, we often take for granted the natural resources we have. People often ask why I sought to be a member of the EQC, particularly when I was retiring out of education as an administrator. And I have six reasons. My six granddaughters, Reagan, Charlotte, Emily, Sarah, Morgan, and Skylar. Future Oregonians, including my granddaughters, all deserve the same quality of life that we have enjoyed over the decades. Being a commissioner on the EQC has given me an opportunity to have a far greater understanding of the challenges that Oregon faces to maintain its natural resources for future generations. They said when I signed up I would have five meetings a year. Over the last year, I think it was five meetings a month. People have asked me, what is the greatest environmental problem we face in Oregon? And I have come to believe that it is the increasing pressure of population growth and visitors without adequate resources to manage and protect our most sensitive areas from damage. And just a quick story, on August 21st, if you want to maybe see the future of Oregon, come to Lincoln City and watch as the world descends for the eclipse. They're already planning an emergency procedure for handling that event. It's pretty amazing. So my wife and I are just going to hole up in our Lincoln City house with our provisions. The Oregon DEQ is the key player, in my belief, to provide the science and data for natural resource agencies and policymakers to make decisions that guide and protect both the environment and the economy in Oregon. In the last few years, I would characterize DEQ as becoming more of a crisis manager as opposed to a proactive environmental leadership organization. The EQC commissioners, our new director, Richard Whitman, and DEQ staff are committed to changing the DEQ into a new model that fosters an Oregon that we can all be proud to live in. We owe that to all of the past Oregonians who sacrificed for this state, and to all future generations, including my granddaughters. Thank you again for your service. Your decisions in this budget area are not easy. But as DEQ staff present their budget requests over the next few days, I want you to know that our commission is dedicated to working with you to protect this precious legacy known as Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair Armstrong.
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, members of the committee, my name is Sam Barassa, and I'm also the second here of our five-member commission on the Environmental Quality Commission. And I'm going to keep my comments short because I can't beat that. but what I will say is I moved to Oregon directly because of the work that Department of Environmental Quality was doing around its nationally recognized innovative environmental policies that balance economic well-being, environmental stewardship, and public health. And it's that work that has, unfortunately, for all the reasons that you are all aware of, have slightly fallen back, but those exist. And this organization, and now in my time and my short time as an EQC member, it's been incredibly humbling to meet with the staff and engage and get that view from the inside and see that there's a lot of need there. And I guess within that time, it's also been a privilege to be able to be part of the decision and bringing on Director Whitman, because he is the leader that this commission needs. What I will say is my background spans finance, environmental modeling, mitigation, banking, community engagement, and with a particular focus on low-income and communities of color. And it's that background that I hope that as we revamp and we bring DEQ back to be a forefront leader, that I hope to bring that to the commission. I hope you see our commitment in terms of myself and Ed being here as a showing of the fact that we are committed to being very involved. And there has been a tremendous amount of meetings that in my 2 months on the commission, I think it's already been like eight. So thank you for your time.
Mr. Barassa, thank you very, very, very much. And as someone who's been a board member and commission member on various boards and commissions, aside from the number of meetings or the number of notebooks, I was always amazed. You needed a Sherpa to pack all that stuff around, so... Well, thank you very much. Please proceed.
Thanks.
Thank you both. All right. Chair Witt, Chair Frederick, members, I want to give you a brief intro to what I'm going to try to do here in the next 2.5 days of time before you. So first of all, I want to go through a brief history of the organization, give you a sense of its overall structure, the central management, the infrastructure of the agency, and then finally go through and show you the what's called the land quality program. One thing that's a little different about this presentation that we're doing this year is we're not just showing you sort of plain vanilla materials around policy option packages and in particular parts of a program. We've tried to put each part of the agency, each program, in a context of what's going on in our environment that program has to do with. So, for instance, on the land quality program today, you'll see information about where are we on hazardous waste sites, where are we on Portland Harbor cleanup. So we're trying to give you some context for each part of the presentation. And then after today, tomorrow, we hope to get through the core programs of the agency in terms of air and water quality. And then finally on day three, we've got the governor's recommended budget along with reduction options and legislation. So that's just a sort of a table of contents, if you will, for where we hope to steer. So I want to start with the mission of the agency. The mission is to be a leader in restoring, maintaining, and enhancing Oregon's air, land, and water. I want to stress two things about this. First of all, this mission is not mutually exclusive with economic development and economic growth. Our whole philosophy is responsible environmental stewardship, work on the environment that goes hand in hand with sustainable communities. The second thing I want to stress is DEQ doesn't do this work alone. We work with local governments. We work with the federal government. We work with community-based organizations. We work with industry. We work with just people on the street, and they're all part of what we do. We have a responsibility as a leader to some degree in some areas, but this is a partnership between a state agency and the rest of the state. Very quickly, some priorities for DEQ right now. One thing that has really changed in this agency over the past year is the linkage between environmental quality and the Oregon Health Authority. We have, I think, drifted away somewhat in the Department of Environmental Quality from some of the roots of the agency, which were in public health, were around protecting people's health. And the experience with our air programs over the course of the last year have really brought home how important it is to very consciously be thinking about human health, not just protection of the environment, but protection of human health. I'm actually very proud to say today the working relationship between the Oregon Health Authority and DEQ is one of the best working relationships that I have ever seen in state government between two agencies. We have folks who are just spending basically all their time together working on these new initiatives. The second thing I want to stress is, again, in terms of DEQ's priorities are public engagement. I mentioned that already. I think there's a belief out there among many that the state doesn't share information with the public. We're holding back information. We're keeping secrets from people. And I'm determined to work to turn that around and to get our agency set up so that we are putting information out proactively for the public, for industry, for permittees, for everybody, so that they can be part of this enterprise of protecting Oregon. Okay. I'd like to next just talk briefly about DEQ's history. I'm not going to go through all of this, but DEQ really has a very strong tradition of being at the forefront nationally on environmental programs. In 1938, we started the State Sanitary Authority to protect water quality. The Federal Clean Water Act is in part based on laws we had in the state of Oregon before the Clean Water Act. Similarly, on air, we started protecting air quality in Oregon in 1951, and the Federal Clean Air Act, again, had some ties back to Oregon's early air pollution efforts. DEQ was formed actually out of the State Sanitary Authority in 1969 during the second year of Governor McCall's term. And very shortly thereafter, somebody you may have heard of, L.B. Day, was appointed as the second director of DEQ. And he really took on cleaning up the Willamette River in particular. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later in the presentation. One thing I want to show you that hasn't changed is around wood smoke.
Wood stove that is clean burning uses substantially less wood for the same BTU output. In addition, it's also safer. Creosote buildup is kept to a minimum, which is one of the major causes of chimney fires and the loss of life and property. I think one of the exciting aspects also of this program is that the federal government, recognizing the significance of wood stove pollution throughout the nation, is just on the verge of enacting national standards for wood stoves also. Again, another example of Oregon leading the nation to be able to address a major pollution source. Switching to water pollution. Wood stove that is clean burning.
So now we're going to have a contest to see who can guess who that is. Any guesses?
Bruce Babbitt. Bruce Babbitt.
No, that actually is
Fred Hansen. Yeah.
That's Fred Hansen. So director of Oregon DEQ back in the 1980s, working away hard on pollution from wood stoves. So the story there is during the first energy crisis in the late 70s, a lot of people shifted their heating to wood stoves because of the cost of oil. And as a result, we had an increase in air pollution in our cities that was as large as the reductions we had been able to accomplish in terms of controlling emissions from industrial sources. So here we are 40 years later, and we're going to be talking to you about wood stove changeouts. We still are struggling with some of the same problems we had 40 years ago.
So I may need staff some technical help here. Do I just close this? Okay. Thank you. Okay.
All right. Very briefly on a little bit more history and more recently. Since 2000, there are a number of major accomplishments, but again, one that I want to underline for you all is the completion of the disposal of chemical weapons munitions at the Umatilla Army Depot. Again, remembering back, as some of us do, to the 1990s, this was a really major deal in the state of Oregon, and it has been completely taken care of, and it's a real success story. It was done on time, under budget. All right. With that, I now want to give you just a very quick introduction to the overall structure of the Department of Environmental Quality. We already talked briefly about the Environmental Quality Commission. And its functions. I'm not going to go back over that. I will briefly mention some of the other commissioners who serve. We have Melinda Eaton, who is a former member of the Northwest Power Planning Council and director of the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance. Morgan Ryder, who's a private sector planner, environmental compliance person. And Colleen Johnson, who is a former economics professor from Eastern Oregon University and former mayor of the city of LeGrand and former past president of the League of Oregon Cities. I just wanted to give you a sense of who's in charge in terms of the commission overseeing this agency. It's a really solid group of people. Okay. I spoke briefly in my intro about the reorganization that was done a couple of years ago. That reorganization created two new divisions, Environmental Solutions and Operations. And the idea was to break down silos between air, water, and land. So you'll see here the concept in Environmental Solutions was essentially to put the forward-looking planning part of the agency in that division, and then to put the operations, the day-to-day operations, under an operations division. But we've got the various air quality programs here in green divided between the two divisions, same with the water programs in dark blue, and then in the land programs, the lighter blue. And again, the result of all that has been, if I am citizen, John Doe, and I want to call DEQ and get an answer on an air quality question, and I look at that organizational chart, I don't know who to call. It's been remarkable to me in the last 6 months the degree to which there's external lack of understanding and internal to DEQ lack of understanding about this structure. I think it was well-intentioned. We're going to try to keep some aspects of it. It has a very strong outcome-based, performance-based management component, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, which is great. But we are planning to go back to the three main divisions. All right. In addition to those two divisions, DEQ does have three major regional offices, each of which is divided into air, water, and land quality. And they're shown on this map. The starred areas in Portland, Bend, and Eugene are the locations for the regional offices. And then we have seven additional field offices throughout the state. So you have DEQ employees living, working, being parts of communities really all across Oregon. Some other facilities of note, we're going to talk about the DEQ laboratory in a few minutes here. That's out in Hillsboro, was moved 6, 7, 8 years ago out to Hillsboro and is co-located with the public health lab out there. I mentioned briefly, but you might have missed it, that we just consolidated our Northwest Region Headquarters office and our main headquarters office in one office in Portland. And then there are the vehicle inspection locations. So a little bit about the basic nature of DEQ's work. You'll hear me and others talk about the fact that a lot of the work that DEQ does is science-based. We're ultimately looking to protect public health and the environment. So the monitoring and assessment of our environment about how are we doing in terms of protecting public health and the environment is a core part of the work that we do. That leads to planning strategies on how to meet standards or improve conditions in air, land, and water. We also have a regulatory role in permitting various activities. We also have a technical assistance role in terms of both local government as well as industry. And then finally, as we are a regulatory agency, we have a compliance and enforcement component as well to our programs. So in terms of how we accomplish our goals and key values for the agency, taking holistic approaches to environmental solutions so we don't have to come back and fix the same thing over and over again, partnerships, engagement, outcome-based management. I want to dwell on the outcome-based management for just a second here. I've mentioned the consolidation of offices in the Portland area. That consolidation is saving us about $765,000 a year and will continue to do so for the next 11 and a half years. So that's a fairly substantial savings for the agency. Another efficiency measure that the agency has taken recently is the installation of video conferencing capability, particularly in our eastern region where we've got folks separated by long distances. So we have substantially reduced the number of meetings that we have to have in person and are able to do by video conferencing through some of those things, again, with some significant cost savings. So we have a whole outcome-based management system within the agency that has some similarity to the key performance measures that you all see, but it's a little bit more focused on internal process improvement. We are constantly looking for areas where we think there are opportunities to improve efficiencies, develop a project, set outcome measures for what the expectations are for those projects, and then get a team together and monitor how they're doing over time. It's a continual effort in the agency. Okay. A few more overview slides. Speaking of key performance measures, the first one, and you see this from all agencies, is customer satisfaction. You'll see that there's actually an improving trend for a number of these measures for DEQ accuracy, availability of information, expertise. The other ones are basically flat. And we have room, significant room for improvement in all of these areas. So while we see some improvement, there's still a lot of work to do. You saw a little bit from the commission. The commission has been good in meeting its key performance measures. We had a little bit of a shortfall this past year, which I believe has been taken care of. So now, along the themes of integrating some of the policy option packages into the presentation, I have this first policy option package to talk to you about. This is package 161, the Environmental Data Management System. This was the number one priority in the agency request budget for the agency. And we just received, not sure how familiar you all are with the new system from the Chief Information Office around StageGate approval, but basically StageGate 1, 2, 3. 1 is the initial sort of concept. 2 is you've mapped out the processes and you're getting ready to actually go out for an RFP, and 3 is actual implementation. So we are just completed StageGate 1 and ready to, and actually already are, diving into the second phase, StageGate 2. There's a large ask here in terms of money. Most of the ask is bond money. But I have one thing that I want to communicate to you immediately, which is in talking with the Legislative Fiscal Office, CIO's office, and others internally, we think it may be more prudent to come back with this bond ask in 2018 rather than today, when we have more information about exactly when, number one, when we're through the StageGate 2 process and we're actually ready to go out for an RFP, and can make sure that we have right-sized this request. So there is still a request here for some funds to keep this effort going. I think we have heard broad support for the need for this effort, but I don't think we're quite ready for the bond ask at this point in time.
Richard, before you before you proceed on that last slide, there was an independent water quality report. Who puts that together?
Chair Witt, Chair Frederick, members. We will talk about this later in the presentation, but there was a budget note in 2015 for an outside consultant to do an evaluation of the main part of the water quality permitting program in DEQ. That report was completed in December and identified a long list of causes of permit backlog around water permits in the agency. Oregon DEQ has one of the worst permit backlogs in the nation for water quality. So there is a linkage between that and this this policy option package. We are going to have the water program be the first substantive program in the agency that works through this phased program. And I didn't mention that, by the way, but this is a phased ask over a number of years. But we will be taking on the water piece of it first. Just to give you a little bit of a flavor of what's involved here, one of the main holdups in getting permits out is a lack of accessible data to the folks who are actually working on the permits. So getting those data in an accessible form at the front end of the process so that the person working on the permit can do so efficiently. At the other end of the permit, when it's been issued, having that information out there for the permittee, having that information out there for the public so they don't have to make a public records request to the agency, that's sort of the back end for the water. But that gives you a sense of the range of data needs involved in this effort. The one other thing I want to say about this package, actually two, sorry. One, it is our firm intent to the maximum extent possible to buy off the shelf on this. The reason we're in the situation we are in is because we have many well-intentioned one-off efforts to design IT systems around particular needs. And you've heard this from probably almost every agency. We can't do that anymore. So off the shelf, number two, we believe this will save both the agency money, significant money in the long term, and frankly, save money for permittees and the public in the long term as well.
So with your very involved background in water, water quality, water quantity, if we're to do a water quality report in this state, would we, rather than all of the different departments and agencies being siloed up, would we not benefit from bringing in the best minds of each of the natural resource departments and agencies and their best scientists to come out with a blueprint for Oregon so that we developed a plan decades ago for salmon and watersheds. How about a blueprint for water quality for the state of Oregon from all of our natural resource departments?
Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, members, there is an effort underway, actually, between the agencies involved in water quality in the state, including DEQ, Department of Agriculture, Department of Forestry, Watershed Enhancement Board, Fish and Wildlife, to put together exactly that vision. And I don't want to overpromise at this point because it's still at an early stage, and we are working hard to get this started well with both some internal organizational effort and also some careful thought about how to engage all the very many stakeholders we have involved in water quality. So I share your feeling that there's a need for that long-term vision for water quality. Oregon is a state where we have had our Department of Agriculture take on the delegated authority for agriculture and the same for Department of Forestry on our forested lands. And I you know, I'm a believer in that, but again, somewhat like the organizational issue within DEQ, sometimes people wonder who's in charge, who has the big picture vision. And I think we have some responsibility as the agencies who are the leaders, plural, on this to put that together.
I just think back, and I'm very pleased to hear that, but I think back to the time when we were very reliant on the IMST and others, and I just think we benefit by bringing all of the scientists and the best scientific information together in one place so that we can create that blueprint going forward. I'm so glad to hear it.
Thank you, Co-Chair.
Thank you.
So with that, I'd like to invite up Brian Bowling, who is the manager for the lab for DEQ, who's going to run through the presentation for that part of our infrastructure.
Afternoon, Co-Chair Witt and Co-Chair Frederick, members of the committee. I'm Brian Bowling. I'm the laboratory program manager for the Department of Environmental Quality. And I oversee our environmental laboratory in Hillsboro. We employ approximately 70 staff that are responsible for monitoring the conditions of Oregon's environment. Our funding is approximately $24 million. We get general fund lottery funds, federal funds, and other funds to support the laboratory. We get about 5% of our funds through other agencies that we do work for, both federal and state agencies, like the Department of Ag.
Not a good steerer.
Our staff are responsible for collecting samples throughout Oregon for both water, air. We collect fish tissue, sediment samples throughout Oregon. Our facility being in Hillsboro, we put a lot of miles on vans going throughout the state collecting these samples. In addition, we have continuous monitoring equipment in the field that allows us to receive temperature data or air quality data directly back to the laboratory. And in cases like our air quality index, that comes back in every hour. We're able to give the citizens an update on what the air quality is in their area. The samples that are collected in the field.
Excuse me? In real time?
In real time. Those samples actually, in for air quality, we have continuous monitors in the field collecting things like carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, particulate matter, ozone, that is all brought back to the laboratory through telemetry to our servers and served up every hour and refreshed. This is the air quality index. So we look at particulate matter and ozone and give the air quality index or good, moderate, and healthy air. And that is updated every single hour.
And how many monitors are we talking about?
In that network, there's about 40 monitors throughout the state that are providing that particulate. And ozone, it's less. There's only about five.
Please. I would like to talk with you at length about the monitors in Portland, especially in North Portland and Northeast Portland. Thank you.
Yep. So in cases, in that case, we have continuous monitors that are feeding this data directly back to the laboratory. In addition, we have grab samples, or what we call grab samples. This is where we actually go in the field, take a bottle, take a fish, and bring it back to the laboratory for processing. Those samples come back to the laboratory and are analyzed for a multitude of compounds. We have, on average, we have probably about 1,500 different compounds that we can look for. Some samples only receive maybe temperature, dissolved oxygen. Others, like in our toxics program, we can be looking for 700 different compounds in that particular sample. Each project has a different cast of characters that we're looking for. The biggest thing about this is making information from it. So when that information is generated or those samples are processed, we want to make information available to the public. We want to make information available to our policymakers and our other staff throughout the agency and other agencies to know what is the health of the environment, what is going on, and how are trends doing it over time, or how is an individual project doing. So in this case, two examples of two products that we have that we produce, the first being the water quality index. This is the longest running trend project that the DEQ does. It goes back to, I believe, the 50s with locations, the first location being on the railroad bridge on the Willamette in Portland. Currently, we run about 33 sites throughout Oregon that generates this water quality index. It is our KPM, and you'll hear more about it in the future. But one of the things that we do is we used to create a big, thick report on this. In recent years, the public wants to consume more of this information. And so now this report that used to be a thick, report that you have to be a scientist to understand is now down to about a 5-page PDF and a web interface with a map that allows you to click on dots, understand that particular location in your area, and what the water quality is for that particular area. These are only for a handful of parameters. We're looking for something like dissolved oxygen, pH. This isn't the water toxic compounds, so this isn't for pesticides and things of that nature. Our lab's ability to produce, look for a number of compounds, we have one of the most sophisticated labs in pretty much in the nation. We have equipment that allows us to see parts per trillion levels. So to kind of put it in context, we can look for pesticides in the size of a postage stamp and the size of California and Oregon combined. So we can look at very low-level trace analysis to understand what the trends are for that, what's increasing, what's decreasing, and overall what the health impact is on the environment. Important programs that we operate, we want to look at the whole story, the whole everything that's going on. And so not only do we look at the chemical composition of the river, we also look at the biological composition of the river. So we run a biological program that looks at the macroinvertebrates to see what the health is of that particular river, what impacts we're seeing, and what is it changing the ecological content of those macroinvertebrates in the river. Switching over to the air quality program, as I talked about earlier, we develop the water air quality index. This is real time to the public that allows communities, schools, that if there's a concern with air quality in the area, most of the time this is related to either really hot creating ozone or fires, where we deploy individual monitors out for a fire location and allow that information to be real time. And so schools can close down, not have kids outside in case of unhealthy conditions. So all of these are important products that the laboratory produces, next slide, that we want to put out into the public's hands and to the individuals within our agency, other agencies, and policymakers. A few numbers for our lab to give me a kind of context to our work. We monitor approximately 1,100 locations in any given year. While that might seem like a lot, some of those locations may only have one thing monitored, like river temperature. Others may have, like I've talked about earlier, 700 different compounds to look for. When you put it in context to the number of river miles that we have in Oregon, that puts about one sample per 100 stream miles. It's not a lot of coverage. So we do our best and look for the target areas that we have concerns, and that's where we put our resources. Flipping over to air, we have about 45 air locations. Some of these are related to the air quality index. Others are related to air toxics monitoring that we also do in the state, and we'll be talking more about that during the air quality program. If you put it in the context of the area of Oregon, it puts one monitor in about 2,200 square miles of Oregon. And overall, we collect about 13,000 samples and process that through the laboratory. That's a substantial amount. And our staff there are dedicated to collecting the information necessary to understand Oregon's environment. I'll turn it over to you.
Questions on the lab?
Just kind of where we're at this point. In order to manage time management here, I would like to, at about 20 past, allow for questions if the subcommittee has any. Thinking that will guarantee us the ability to adjourn on time. If there aren't questions, then we could finish up the last 10 minutes with additional presentation if that works.
Yeah,
thank sounds you. Good. Thank you. Questions from the subcommittee at this point? Representative Esquivel, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things. One is that on the monitoring part, it seems like in Medford we get whacked every time we have our cruise day, and we don't really know what to do about that, because when you have 57 Chevy that's burning nothing but bad, what do we do there? Are you going to help us out on that, Richard?
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, maybe we could try to do it on a windy day.
the next thing is I&M. I want to talk about I&M.
Okay.
About 27 years ago, we had on the ballot INM, and it was statewide. It wasn't just confined to Jackson County. But when that presentation happened, if my memory serves me correct, it would be for 20 years and that would go away because cars were coming on with adequate emission control on them. Well, it's been 27 years, not 20 years. We still have that in place. And what throws me, just astounds me, it's only for half the county. Why do we still have it if it's only for half the county? Well, I didn't understand why it was for half the county in the first place. But if you go from Medford and you go to White City, White City doesn't have to go through INM, but Medford does. Eagle Point doesn't. Shady Cove Trail, Prospect View Falls, Central Point does, I believe.
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, Representative Esquivel. A great question. We get this question quite a bit on the vehicle inspection program. And the basic answer is the amount of air pollution that is avoided as a result of the vehicle inspection program is still very substantial. The studies that have been done that show how much pollution would be emitted if we didn't have such a program versus what we have with it, it's a substantial amount. And as we're going to see when we get into the air presentation, that can have real consequences for communities if it pushes them into something called non-attainment, because then there can be limitations on economic growth. One further thing, we are working hard to make the process more efficient and more customer friendly. So self-service lanes at vehicle inspection stations. We're also working with several companies on an app that you can have on your phone where you can go to an auto dealer and plug into their machine and have your emissions tested that way. So we are trying to we know that this is not a happy experience for everybody, but we're trying to make it as efficient as possible while still meeting the very real environmental gains that we get from it. As to the White City piece, I think it's because of the way the urban area designation was done back when the program was first established, but we'll have to confirm that for you. We'll follow up.
Yes, and I believe that includes Gold Hill, Rogue River, on out through that whole northern part of the county is outside. Mm-hmm. If you lived there, you wouldn't have to go through INM, but yet everyone commutes into Medford. So I'm a little confused.
So now we know why everybody's moving out there.
That's right. They don't have to pay that $10 a year or whatever. Yeah. And everyone's pretty much adjusted to it because it's been going on for 20 some years. But I just haven't figured out why half the county's out of it.
So, again, and then we can follow up in more detail if you'd like, but Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, we're still seeing significant environmental benefit. Remember, it's the older vehicles that are subject to the inspection.
Follow up.
Yes.
Well, the problem is, Richard, is that a vehicle over 20 years old doesn't have to go through it.
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, Representative Esquivel, I'd have to follow up with you on the reasons for that. I can't do that off the top of my head. Sorry.
Very good. Thank you. Additional questions or comments at this point? Representative Power.
I'm wondering, I'm looking back at the package 161.
Yeah.
There's a mention at the bottom of the page that it's going to resolve federal compliance issues about electronic reporting. Can you maybe explain what those are currently and how it's going to address those?
Yes, Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, Representative Power. The federal government over the last several years, longer actually, has started to require electronic reporting of discharges. I know in the water program, I don't know as much on air, but certainly in the water program they require e-reporting, and we're not currently compliant with EPA requirements. and EPA has noted that in their assessment report, and so this is one of the co-benefits, if you will, of putting this program in place. It will allow permittees to e-report.
Co-Chair Frederick.
Yes, thank you. I want to go back, if you don't mind coming up for again. I know we should talk later on, but I wanted to make sure that this is part of the record. You mentioned monitors. One of the key concerns that we have in my district is clearly the air monitoring. And we only have, as I recall, how many? We have a traveling one or a mobile one, and then one other monitor. Is that correct?
So it depends on which program we're looking at. So in the case of our air quality index in the Portland area, we have, I believe, three monitors, Hillsboro, North Portland, Southeast Lafayette, for the particulate monitoring. In the case of air toxics, and we'll talk a little bit more about this during the air program, we do have air toxics, two permanent locations being North Portland and La Grande, where we look for air toxics, and then we have four rotating annual air toxics monitors that rotate throughout the state. Currently, two of those are deployed in Southeast Portland and Gresham, and then two others are getting deployed. We're citing them where those are going to go in the state right now, and actually building out the trailers. Those came in the policy option package that we received last biennium.
Two aspects of that interest me. One is, how much do those mobile units cost?
So we actually have a policy option package that you'll see during our air program that's requesting six additional. These would be trend sites where they'll actually be planted for a longer period of time to be able to look at long-term trends. Currently, our monitoring, the rotating sites, we're there for a year and then we go away. And we may not get back, and sometimes we haven't gotten back. So we get a snapshot in time. Those monitors, there's about $110,000 to $130,000 worth of capital outlay that goes into each one of those sites. And the FTE costs, I believe, in our package is 7 FTE for the six sites, and that's to run those networks.
And are they able to test for, are they particular toxins that they're testing for?
Yes. We do what's called our standard toxic suite. So we look at volatile organic compounds. We look at combustion byproducts, things like formaldehyde, aldehydes, ketones, metals. It's our full suite. They're modeled off of what is called the ambient air toxics network. From the federal level, and we look for the same compounds that we look for in our trend sites in Portland and La Grande.
Well, obviously, one of the reasons that I'm thinking about this is because of our issues regarding the Moss studies.
Yes.
And the discovery of chromium and a number of other bad things throughout the Portland area. Are these new monitoring sites or equipment able to test for those particular issues, or is that too much, or in a different need different equipment for that?
They actually do all of the metals that we did in Portland during the last year, during the Moss follow up in the work that we've been doing in Portland. That work was actually directly all the same air toxics metals that we look for in our normal sites. Plus what's called hexavalent chromium. So those are part of our standard suite of air toxics that we do.
The two, I'm going to stop and right now, but it occurs to me that we have two monitoring sites in North Portland that you mentioned. One is stationary, I believe that's over near Jefferson High School.
That's correct.
And the other one is where?
Right now, we have North Portland, which is stationary. We have a rotating one, which is in Southeast Portland next to PCC. And then out in Gresham is a third.
The concern, quite frankly, for my neighborhood is both the result of the Moss study and not knowing this until the Moss study, and then the inability to really have an impact on the what's coming up from Swan Island. And clearly affecting the homes and people having to leave their homes in the middle of the night because of the of toxic fumes that have still not been officially identified as where they're coming from. Everyone suspects certain one particular company, but they can't seem to get to that. Is there a way to deal with that, even though this has been going on for several decades and apparently with no indication that that's an issue at the Jefferson High School site? We can't find any problem officially.
With the Jefferson High School site, it's kind of that's through the paid for by EPA, and so it's the federal site, and it kind of that's the site that they select. We did have our Swan Island site above Swan Island in 2015. I guess it was 13 and 15 that site. We've put that data out, and we're also in addition working through odor issues around Swan Island at this point. And the lab's working on a report right now that'll be going out around the odors.
That'd be good, because that's one of the things that we get an awful lot of discussion and concerns about. The odor may not be officially toxic as far as many chemists might be concerned, but I'll tell you, it pushes people out of their homes regularly, and the answers they've gotten so far from DEQ and the state have been very much under what they should be. There's no real sense that folks are getting a good answers from the state on that. So as we look at monitoring, as we look at those particular issues, we've got to find a new level of confidence for the people who are living around those areas. Thank you.
Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Earlier you mentioned the backlog in the permitting process. Is that across all of your program areas, or is it primarily water? And what do you attribute it to? Is it electronic reporting or manual data, or what is it?
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, Representative Lewis, the backlog issue is it's primarily in one part of the water permitting program. There is a little bit of a backlog in the air program that we're keeping an eye on, but the main issue here is on the water permitting, and it's really specifically for municipalities and for the larger industrial discharges where we've got such a problem. Causes everything from internal to DEQ organizational issues to lack of resources to legal difficulties in getting defensible permits out the door to practical problems with the configuration of facilities to the financial capacity of local governments to pay for what's needed to the technical capacity of local government. I mean, it's just across the board. It's going to require a sustained broad effort to make a dent in.
Yeah. All right. With that, I'm going to thank our guests very much for their presentation to this point. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5518 for the day. And I'll tell everyone in the audience, it was a pleasure to see the room full today. I watch your body language, though, and I think we need to jazz it up a little bit. So,
I'll try.
So next time we're considering a whole session regression analysis on DEQ's tailpipe emissions and how that impacts outward migration of the population in our state's major metropolitan areas. Be here or be square. We're adjourned. B square. We're adjourned.